Chapter 19. Attorneys Threatened. When court adjourned at noon on Friday, August 16th, 3 weeks had been occupied in the taking of evidence, and the end was not yet in sight. It was predicted that all of the next week would be taken up in the introduction of rebuttal and surrebuttal evidence and arguments to the jury. This was correct. The trial did not end until near the middle of its fifth week. The lawyers were almost exhausted. It had been a severe strain on all of them. Court convened daily at 9 o'clock and remained in session until 12:30, when recess was taken for dinner. This lasted an hour and a half. At 2 o'clock, court resumed, and the evening adjournment was not taken until about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Every one of the attorneys was constantly on the alert. If he was not questioning, he was following in his mind the trend of the testimony, ready to interpose an objection or fight over some questionable legal point. During the first 3 weeks, Luther Rosser, one of the most stalwart lawyers in the South, lost 25 pounds in weight. Solicitor Dorsey became pale and nervous, and Reuben Arnold and Frank Hooper showed traces of the terrific strain. The lawyers for the defense were working under an added hardship also. They received numerous threatening letters from all parts of the state. They were the communications of fanatics who were radically in sympathy with the move of Solicitor Dorsey to send the prisoner to the gallows. During the whole trial, Reuben Arnold was followed by a bodyguard of 3 men, while his brother lawyer Rosser had 2 constantly at his side. They were hedged about like a president with Secret Service operatives. Telegrams and letters of advice and condemnation also poured into the attorneys for both sides from all parts of the country. One man in Nashville, Tennessee, spent at least $100 in writing to Mr. Rosser's suggestions and hints as to how to proceed with the presentation of the case of the defense. The Tennessean had a chart, he said, by which he could tell just what move to make next. These communications were, of course, disregarded, if they were ever read. The fourth week of the trial marked a tightening of tension over the whole city. The crowds around the courthouse grew louder and more demonstrative. An added force of policemen and deputy sheriffs kept them in order. During the whole trial, Leo M. Frank was probably the coolest man directly connected with the case. His expression and bearing never changed. He was always the same stoic, impassive Frank. He stood the long, hot, grueling trial with the composure and patience he inherited from a race of people who had been persecuted for eons. His mother and his wife, too, withstood the strain well. Only on the one occasion did the elder Mrs. Frank display emotion or passion. In the courtroom, she sat at the left of her son, with her eyelids drooping. Mrs. Leo Frank sobbed occasionally and frequently fondled her husband's hands while he was hearing commendation and denunciation from the mouths of witnesses. At times, when the evidence against her husband seemed particularly severe, she rested her head on his shoulder, and tears rolled down her face, and her frame shook. Probably the most remarkable feature of the whole Frank case was the way the young man's friend stuck by his side in his hour of need. During his 3 months' wait in the county jail for trial, there was always someone at the door of his cell, and they were present in the courtroom by the scores. Rabbi David Marks of the Atlanta Synagogue denied himself a trip to Europe that he might remain in Atlanta to comfort the president of the B'nai B'rith. Moses Frank, the millionaire uncle of the defendant, was unable to be present at the trial. He was ill in Europe, and when his nephew was charged with one of the most horrible crimes in Georgia's criminal history, he was unable to return to America. Frank's father also, who lived in Brooklyn, New York, was unable to be present on account of ill health. The trial was the longest in the history of the South, and Frank stood it as well as any prisoner who ever faced the scaffold. Not once did he waver. The state made no attack upon his mentality. Even Solicitor Dorsey described him as a mental colossus, with a brain capable of great things if driven in the right direction. The references made to the defendant in the arguments to the jury which closed the famous trial are worthy of mention. These were the comments of the four leading attorneys. Attorney Luther Z. Rosser. You heard him on the stand. You can take a counterfeit dollar of the right size and the right weight, one that would fool the Secretary of the Treasury, and drop it, and it will not have the ring of the genuine. Arnold or I could have told his story, but it would not have had the ring of truth to it. I have proof that I never wrote his statement. I couldn't have done it. He has more brains than either of us. You heard his story. It had the ring of truth to it, unmistakable, irrefutable. This man is a victim of suspicious circumstances. It was an awful crime, the killing of that little girl. But it is a far worse crime to accuse this young man of her murder. I hope I never see this trial duplicated in a courtroom. Attorney Reuben R. Arnold. We are not claiming perfection for this defendant, gentlemen, any more than we claim it for ourselves, or you claim it for yourselves, or Solicitor Dorsey and his associates claim for themselves. But he is a moral gentleman. The greatest injustice in this case has been the whispered, unspeakable things, the very suspicion of which is damning. The state has built its case on Conley's statement, and it stands or falls with it. As that negro lay in his cell at the police station, he conjured up the story he has told. And it was monstrous. If we hang a man on a story like that, we are no better than grub worms. I am glad to espouse this man and fight for his cause. I know the public eventually will commend me for it, and I know my own conscience will commend me. Solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey. I believe these poor, unprotected working girls who say he is of bad character. Sometimes a man of bad character uses charitable and religious organizations to mask his real self. Many a man has worked in high society and appeared without as a whited sepulchre while he was rotten to the core within. Oscar Wilde, brilliant, whose literary works will go down through the ages, had a good reputation, but he didn't have the character. This man has a reputation, and that is all. He has no character. As sure as you are born, that man is not like other men. Others without Mary Fagan's stamina and character yielded to his lust, but she did not, and he strangled her to save his reputation. His hands are red with her blood. Attorney Frank A. Hooper. This defendant, like Dr. Jekyll, when the shades of night came, threw aside his mask of respectability and was transformed into a Mr. Hyde. And then he did not seek the companions of Dr. Jekyll, but like Hyde, he went to a lower stratum, where he picked up Dalton in his kind. And he went with them instead of the men who have come here to give him a good character. The factory was a great place for a man with lust and without conscience. No doubt the situation under which this man worked was a great temptation, too great for him. We say a crime was premeditated, that as far back as March Frank had his lustful eyes on this little girl. He knew that Gant, this long-legged mountaineer, was the only man in the factory who would raise his hand to protect her, so he discharged him. On the morning of Monday, August 18th, Solicitor Dorsey said that he stood ready to prove that on Saturday morning preceding the murder, Frank was accompanied by a young girl on a long ride on the Hapeville line, and that he had endeavored to induce her to leave the car at several different places. Miss Emily Mayfield, one of the employees of the factory, who was named by Miss Irene Jackson as having been in the dressing room when Frank opened the door and looked in, repudiated this testimony. She declared that on no occasion had she known the superintendent to conduct himself improperly toward the women employees. By other witnesses introduced at the 12th hour by the defense, the solicitor brought out the fact that Frank and Conley had been on the fourth floor of the factory at the same time on the Tuesday following the murder. It was at this time, according to Conley, that Frank called him aside and admonished him to be a good boy.